Hello, world, and welcome to another episode of Polar Opposites. That's the PO Show right here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Big T, and as always, you know I'm joined by my main man, Cool Hand Phil. That's my friend, your friend, soon to be everybody's friend. Phil, how are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic, man. How about yourself?
Man, as always, you know, I'm just glad to be here. And it's that time of the year, Phil, NBA playoff time. And it just can't be NBA playoffs on the PO Show if we don't bring in Indiana's own Basketball Hall of Famer, Ron Rutland Jr. Ron, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure is truly all ours. We're going to get this thing started off right away. We start the show like we do every single show. As adults, you make plenty of decisions every day. We're just glad that you decided to spend a little time with us here on the PO Show. Now, Phil, normally I'll say to you about all the things that have happened in the past week since we last spoke, but this week's a little different. It's really more about all the things that will happen before we meet again. I mean, before we talk again, we'll have this first round of the playoffs, NBA playoffs, wrapped up in its entirety by all accounts. We'll also have ourselves a new pound-for-pound undisputed best of the best in the boxing world because, of course, the fight of the century is this Saturday with Floyd Mayweather going up against Manny Pacquiao. And we will also put to rest, Phil, the age-old debate about who is the number one overall pick in the NFL draft. Will that be Marcus Mariota? Will it be Jameis Winston? Or a player to be named later? Fact of the matter is, when we get back together this time next week, we'll have answers to all of those questions. But the burning question that I want to get into right now at the top of the show, and I'm going to start it out with you, Ron, because I need your on-the-court expertise for this. I need your experience playing basketball at a high level. I'm going to take you right to what everybody's talking about, the Kevin Love injury. Is Kevin Love's injury a result of a dirty play by Kelly Olynyk?
Okay, and the way you phrase it, it is the result of I hate to call it a dirty play because, I mean, that's not unusual in basketball. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still play in men's leagues now, and it happens all the time. You get close to a guy, you put your arm close to him, he'll grab it, lock it, you know, to try to keep him from moving or being able to get to a ball. Mm-hmm. And I just believe, you know, with him grabbing Kevin Love's arm, locking it, and then Kevin Love trying to go the opposite direction, you know, it was just the worst result that could have happened. Mm. It was a legal play. I wouldn't say dirty.
Okay.
Obviously, there's no way he knew he was going to pull his arm out of
sight.
I just don't believe that.
Mm. Yeah, Phil, what you got on this?
Well, you know, Ron kind of contradicted himself. You know, he says he plays in a men's league, and that happens all the time, and then he says that play's not dirty. We all know that men's league, yeah, none of us have dirty played up there. That's all these guys do. You ever played with some old men? Man, those are the dirtiest rascals you ever could play with. But, No, I mean, I don't know. I'm glad that you brought this up because I haven't heard anybody else really talk about that. When I've read about what happened to Kevin Love, when I've seen the video, I haven't heard anyone bring this aspect of the conversation up. But when I saw it, it did look a little suspect. And I don't want to say the guy was trying to hurt Kevin Love, but it did look a little suspect with the way that, as Ron described it, kind of locked his arm up. It did look like he was, you know, doing a little extracurricular activities on that. Mm-hmm. But it happened so quick, you know, he locked it and then let it go. So I think, you know, his intention was just to pull Kevin Love back a little bit, you know, slow his progress down and gain leverage so that he could propel himself to the ball. So I don't know if he was trying to injure Kevin Love, but it did look like it's at least worth the discussion, because I thought it did look a little strange. I don't know, just the movement, the motion that he made, it did look, it looked painful.
Sure.
So I don't know what his intentions were, but I'm just glad we're having the conversation, because I thought there may have been a little ill will there, but in all likelihood, probably not, but it just looks strange.
Yeah, and you're right, Phil. I've searched the national media high and low, and I'm not hearing anybody speak out against the play definitively. I mean, in fact, the entire country is going along with the narrative that Ron just said, that, you know, the plays, this type of play happens all the time. It's not uncommon to see this type of play, and in fact, when that type of play happens, you know, they lock arms, they let go, and to your point, Phil, no ill will was intended. But I disagree emphatically for a lot of reasons. First and foremost, if it was anybody else that locked up with Kevin Love, I might buy that. If it were a Michael Carter Williams or somebody else, but it was Kelly Olynyk. The guy logged 3 minutes in the previous game. No shots. I mean, his box score was clean. In this particular game, no points. That says to me that he's a goon. That says to me that Stevens, Brad Stevens, is putting this guy in for one purpose and one purpose. I mean, if it was hockey, you'd see him skating around without a stick, just looking for somebody to hit. I mean, that's how I felt when I looked at the box score and I see this guy in the game. Now, I'm going to agree with you, though, Ron, in the first part of that you're right. You do see it oftentimes when they're trying to block out. They'll hook an arm to prevent a guy from going for a rebound. And that the hook wasn't my question. What I questioned was the opposite arm that he chose to use to put force in the opposite direction of the hook, which, in fact, resulted in the arm being dislocated. You know,
And Terrence, to your point, I think that's what looked strange to me, is that he used both arms. Like, he used one to straighten it out, and the other one, you know, defended, you know, the wrong. But to me, it just looked a little strange, but it happened so fast, it was hard to say. But to your point, that's what looked different to me, is he grabbed it with both arms, and it seemed like he was trying to put pressure.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to put more pressure on the elbow,
right,
to me, but it just resulted in a shoulder injury.
Yeah, I mean, in any other sport, I don't know, MMA, we'd have called it an arm bar. I mean, and that's what it was.
Ronda Rousey.
Yeah, I can't really call it a basketball play. I can't say it was a routine basketball play. And obviously, the powers that be saw it that same way, because he did receive a one-game suspension, which is obviously a joke, because, well, A, like I said, he's a goon. I mean, he gets 3 or 5 minutes a game. So that, you know, that doesn't matter. Now I will say this. Now, if you go back and you check the box score, in the first game, he actually had significant minutes. And looked like he even had his shot drop, and he scored some points through. But past that, every game past that, he had goon-like minutes. So, it's suspect at the least, you know, the fact that he was even on the floor at that time, because he's obviously not a starter. I mean, if you go back and you look at the roster, the matchups at that time, Cleveland had starters on the floor. What the heck is this dude do? I mean, I'm telling you, man, he was a goon. there's really no other way to look at it. At that point in the game,
he's played significant minutes.
Huh?
He's played significant minutes during the season.
Well,
it's less than in the playoffs a little bit, but I know what you're saying, but I don't know. He hadn't been a goon all season.
You're not ready to sign off on goon minutes, huh? Okay. Well.
No. Now your boy on the other side, yes.
Oh, now Kendrick Perkins. Kendrick Perkins is. I mean, he might as well change the back of his jersey to goon. He doesn't even fake his hard fouls to look like basketball plays. I mean, Perkins, boy, when he dropped, I believe it was Crowder, was it? When he dropped Crowder, I was like, Lord have mercy. But again,
J.R. Smith dropped Crowder too.
Yeah, well, now J.R. Smith.
I'm not going
to
get to that.
Yeah, now J.R. Smith put him out the game. But prior to that, Perkins put him on his backside with a, I can't even call it a hard screen. I mean, he put him down.
I've never seen a chokehold screen in my life. That's the first time ever. I played basketball. I've never seen a chokehold screen come.
But I'm going to tell you though. But that's how you know Olenek was a goon, because Perkins came out in retaliation of that. You know, but this really brings up a bigger point. Now Phil kind of talked about the J.R. Smith ejection. Subsequent foul and ejection leading to a 2-game suspension. On top of Kevin Love, and now we're hearing today that Kevin Love is expected not to return throughout the rest of the playoffs. So I guess that brings this first question I'll ask. If you are the Cavaliers, which one of those in these next games coming up, although Milwaukee did their part in extending the Chicago series with a win last night, which one of these absences will be greater felt by the Cavaliers the next time they take the court, whether it be to play Milwaukee or Chicago, whoever it may be, the loss of Kevin Love or the loss of J.R. Smith, which one's going to hurt the team worse?
But Dan, I want to hear your take on this before we get hard. Which one do you think is going to be a bigger loss?
Well, I'm a little bit torn on it, but we know that in playoff basketball, winning the boards is a lot of the wins. If you can control the boards, you can and will win games. And let's face it, that's what Kevin Love brings to the table. Sure, it's nice that he can be a second scoring option, as we saw in the game where Kyrie Irving just wasn't having it. And Kevin Love, I think this would have been in game 3, Kevin Love came alive with 26 points. So that's a nice luxury to have. But let's not get beside ourselves. It's the 19 rebounds. You know, it's the double-double that he's known for is what you like. And it's not the first part of the double, the points. It's really the rebounds. So that's a big part of it. However, that would be the sexy answer. That would be the quick and easy answer. But I will say, if you think back, Phil, we've been saying it all season long, when is Kevin Love going to show up? Where is the Kevin Love we knew and loved? So they've been winning in spite of Kevin Love all season long. But if you know, and Ron mentioned this when we spoke last week, that we didn't really take Cavaliers serious until they made the trade to bring in Shumpert and J.R. Smith. That's when we knew that the roster was complete. They had some complementary pieces, and they finally had some semblance of a bench. So quite honestly, I think the games that J.R. Smith is going to be out, I think that hurts the team more than Kevin Love. I know that sounds backwards, but that's where I'm at.
No, you know, I think that makes sense. But, you know, speaking about J.R. Smith and while he got ejected or, you know, suspended the 2 games, but as you mentioned about this weekend, you know, the big fight, you know, we have to put $99 down, but we probably won't even see a knockout like J.R. Smith had. And I'm kind of surprised that he only got 2 games. I mean, that just, I don't know. I just figured you'd get, 5 games at the minimum, you know, for that type of action. But I'm not surprised by your answer, and I'm really surprised that when you read about Kevin Love's injury and everyone's take on it, you know, they're acting like it's a really big deal. But all season long, all we've heard is, you know, Kevin Love is ineffective, Kevin Love is not fitting in, Kevin Love is not doing that. Now that he's hurt, now all of a sudden it's a big deal. So I really don't understand where people are coming from, because you can't have it both ways. You can't say the guy's ineffective, and then when he gets hurt, you act like it's going to be a big deal. But I think the Kevin Love presence being missed is going to be a bigger deal than J.R. Smith, because of the first reasons that you mentioned about the offensive board. But that scoring threat, I don't think what people realize is, even though he's not putting points on the board, he is still creating points with his presence on the court, because you have to account for all the ways that he can score the basketball. You know, he can move outside and make shots, and what that does is create open lanes for Irving and LeBron and those types of things. So I think it will be a big deal. You know, just like Bosh in Miami, you know, you can't have three bigs. There's no such thing, because you don't have enough basketballs to support three bigs.
Right.
So we knew that somebody was going to get lost in the mix, and that's Kevin Love, but I think he's not getting credit for what he does bring, just because he may not be, you know, filling up the stat sheet, but I think he's opening up opportunities for the players that, you know, you may see some of those opportunities dwindle in this next series. I'll be interested to see how that plays out, but I think his absence could prove to be a bigger deal than what we realize.
What about you, Ron?
Yeah, I'm kind of like you, Tim. I'm kind of torn between, because obviously both will be greatly missed, especially when you're missing both of them at the same time, the first two games of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what they both bring, you know, I love JR's, you know, energy defensively, you know, the ability to knock down an open shot and just his fearless play. And the fact that Kevin Love, you know, can stretch the floor. Like Phil said, you got to account for him on the floor. So even, you know, if you think, you know, he's not doing anything, his presence out there, you know, as a defender, you have to be accountable for.
Yes.
And, you know, so if I had to lean one way, I would only probably lean the way of Kevin Love because of the longevity of the time that he will be away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll get JR back in game three. You know, hopefully you won't be in a bad position by that time.
Sure.
But since, you know, they're saying right now, like you said, you know, the reports is that he's not possibly even coming back at all this series or the rest of the playoffs, I'm going to say that's the bigger impact on the team.
Yeah, you know, it's just funny how it immediately changed the conversation of the Cavaliers being the team to beat in the East, and now all of a sudden you're looking around, and it literally overnight Chicago seemed like became the favorite. Atlanta fell apart some kind of way. All of a sudden they're locked up in a 2-2 tie with Brooklyn. That game was did they play tonight? Atlanta Brooklyn.
Oh, that's a good question.
Don't think so, because
No, they played yesterday, I believe.
Right, that's right. That was the let's see. If they played yesterday, then they would have won. Yeah, they're all tied up at two. Yeah, they're tied up two games apiece in that game. So, you know, so all of a sudden, Atlanta, the best record in the East, you know, in the 1-8 matchup, you don't expect that to be all locked up 2-2, but here it is. So, you know, they've shown some vulnerabilities. Obviously, with the injuries and the suspensions, now Cleveland is perceived to be vulnerable. And all, like I said, overnight, Chicago, by default, just got better. and they may be the favorite now in the East. And matter of fact, that is my question. So if in fact this weakens Cleveland, and I'm not signing off that it does, I'm still contending that they won without Kevin Love during the regular season. I mean, keep in mind, he wasn't even on the floor in the fourth quarter in most of their games and closeout time. So they won without him. And, of course, you know, Cleveland still has a guy on their team named LeBron James. So that's always got to be accounted for. But if you subscribe to what what popular media wants you to believe, that, oh, no, you know, it's all over for Cleveland, who would you say would be the heir apparent then to take this their rightful spot and win the Eastern Conference Finals? Would it be Chicago? Would it be Atlanta? Or is there a dark horse in Brooklyn?
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I think it's Chicago. I mean, I'll go ahead and let Ron go, but, I mean, just a short answer, I think you're right. I think it's Chicago.
Yeah, I would probably agree. And just from the standpoint of, you know, I'm kind of with you, Terrence. I don't think it weakens them that much. I think they'll still be there, to be honest. But if I had to choose second favorite, it would be, I would say, Chicago. If Derrick Rose, you know, which he's not playing bad right now, I mean, he's playing, you know, showing some good flashes. I just like what they bring defensively. And, you know, to me, to win it all or even get there, you still, you know, have to have an inside presence. And with Gasol and, you know, Noah, I still believe they have that.
Right.
I'm just not sold that, you know, some of these guard-oriented, you know, just three-point shooting teams, you know, that's going to be, you know, it'll probably be the way of the future. I just don't think it's quite there yet, the championship talent.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I was just thinking the other day, I was sitting here and I was trying to think in my mind, in the playoffs, who has the best big man tandem? And I was thinking, okay, is it DeAndre Jordan and Blake Griffin? Is it Zebo and Marc Gasol? Or is it Powell and Noah? And I just kept kind of going back and forth. Or, I don't know, maybe even throw Lopez and with Portland, Lopez and can't even think of my guy's name. Who plays the four in Portland?
Aldridge.
Yeah. So I was kind of going through that. So that's actually a pretty good question. So I'll put that out there. What do you guys see as the best tandem, big man tandem? Oh, and I guess I got to put Dallas. I guess you got to put Dirk and Chandler for Dallas. But who do you see as the best tandem, big man tandem out there right now, still playing in the playoffs? I would tend to say, I actually do think it's Powell. Oh man, it's a tough. I'm gonna go ahead and say Powell and Noah.
Well, I mean, would Draymond Green and Andrew Bogut, would they count?
That's a good one.
You know, he plays like a big, but he's more like a power forward. But he does go down low and bang quite a bit.
That's a good one to mix in. Yeah, go ahead.
And, you know, it's crazy though that you mentioned all these teams that you mentioned. I mean, that's quite a few teams. That's almost every team there. And, you know, we feel like it's more of a guard league now. You know, shooters, that the big man, you know, kind of like the NFL, a lot of focus has been taken off of the running back. It's kind of like that in the NBA. You just don't see really the emphasis on the big man play anymore. But every team that you've mentioned, I mean, it seems like they have a very serviceable duo as far as their big man goes. So I am kind of surprised that you were able to name so many guys that I recognize that I would say, yeah, they contribute quite a bit. Even like Dirk and Chandler. I mean, Chandler doesn't contribute on the offensive end, even though he just threw that dunk down.
Yeah, he did.
But he's more of a defensive guy. But, I mean, that's part of basketball. I mean, if you can make an impact on the defensive side of the ball plus rebounding, I mean, you have to grade that in as far as being a part of that duo. So, I was really surprised you were able to mention that many names.
Well, and let me tell you what, and the two names that I didn't mention, and they were the catalysts to get me on this line of thinking, and maybe because they don't necessarily start together, but what really got me going on it was watching Josh Smith and Dwight Howard. I think it may have been in game 2 or 3 of that series,
right,
when they were just going ham. I mean, it was a dunk fest. Alley-oop after alley-oop after alley-oop, and I was saying to myself, I don't recall seeing two big men play in tandem in concert so well together like that, you know, over a stretch of, I don't know, that stretch, I don't know, it probably lasted almost the entire quarter. I think in that one quarter, Smith had something retarded like 9 assists. It was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. But I don't think they have him in the starting lineup, maybe not tonight anyway or whatever, but they play together in a limited role. They don't, you know, they're not always on the court together. So I didn't necessarily qualify those two. But then of course, you know, talking about that, you know, you can't even really have this conversation without bringing up Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan. Although they're more of an offensive powerhouse, you know, than defense. And the reason I picked Powell and Noah was their defensive prowess.
But, you know, when you talk about a tandem that kind of makes your team go, you know, DeAndre and
Blake.
You just said his name, like Blake Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those two guys, I mean, that's who I think of. They make that team go. I mean, of course, with Chris Paul stirring the drink. But that would probably be my vote just because they are so, you know, you just see their impact just so immediately. You know, it's not like it's on the defensive end of the ball. I mean, they're putting points on the board and they play off of each other. So that would be my vote for the best tandem.
What you got, Ron?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough pick, but I'll probably say for me, and I'm just, I mean, I'm just a fan of these two guys when I watch them play, is Mark Gasol and Z-Bo and Zach Randolph.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah,
those two together. And, you know, out of all the teams that you mentioned, they are the go-to guys.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Both of them, you know, versus each team, you know, one is a go-to guy, the other is, you know, the defender rebounder.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the only tandem that, you know, they both can post up, they both get the ball, they get a lot of touches, and they score.
Right.
So, you know, that's definitely my pick of the best tandem.
Yeah, you definitely bring up a good point there, and that battle that's going on right now in that series, Z-Bo and Aldridge, that's some. If you like to watch, you know, post up play down in the post, that matchup every night has been fascinating to watch, to say the least. And what's fascinating about it, if you look at their body types, you say to yourself, well, there's no way Z-Bo can keep up with Aldridge. You look at it on paper and you're like, oh, this is a mixed match, no doubt. But somehow, Z-Bo gives it just as good as he gets, night in, night out. It's really been a fascinating matchup to watch. Now, Phil, you brought up Griffin and DeAndre Jordan, and we didn't bring this up in the production meeting, but it's something that's been on my mind, too, watching this Spurs and Clippers matchup. You know, Ron, of course, had said at the top of the season, playoff season, that he wasn't giving up on the Spurs, felt like they still had something left in the tank, and I laughed. And lo and behold, it would appear that the Spurs are at least in the battle, if not in control of it. But I still think the Spurs are in trouble, and I say that because a savvy coach like Popovich is deploying the hack of DeAndre, the hack of Shaq, on DeAndre Jordan. And I find that despicable. I'm interested in how you guys view that tactic, the old hack of Shaq. Does it have its place in basketball? Is it smart? Or is it just a cheap maneuver to get a cheap maneuver to get an advantage on your opponent?
Yeah, I mean, as for me, I don't have a problem with it, and I'm pretty sure they'll probably change that rule this offseason, and I'll be saddened by that, you know, because I think that is a part of the game. I mean, you're having to give up fouls, and I just don't like the rules that they make for different parts of the game. Like, you know, they're going to say the last 2 minutes of a half, you can't do that. Well, you know, to me, if you can't do something, it should be you can't do it the whole game.
Exactly.
I've never understood why they make these, you know, rules where they only apply the last 2 minutes. I just don't like that. But I have nothing, and if they make the rule go away, I mean, I don't think it's going to change the game for me to where, like, it's unwatchable. But I just do not have a problem with it. You know, whenever they foul these guys and they put them on the line, you know, that's part of it. Just like if they change that rule, I mean, what are they going to do when, you know, you're trying to foul at the end of the game to put someone on the line, you know, how's that going to affect that when you're down by 2 points? Okay, we got a foul to stop the clock. So I don't know how they're going to figure all that out, but I don't have a problem with it. So, but you're right, you know, about that Clippers and Spurs, you know, you wouldn't let me rebut last week on that point you made. But, you know, leave it up to friends. You know, we're always going to point out each other's downfalls. So, of course, I had to text you after that and say, well, I guess the Spurs made my rebuttal for me. And then I heard that even Ron, I heard he jumped in and, you know, kicked you while you were down, too. So, you know, you've got two good friends here supporting you, Terrence. You know, don't feel bad.
Oh, yeah. The next morning, y'all were both almost in concert. Y'all were getting me, giving me the business the next morning. But, yeah, it's definitely a good series, and we'll see how it all pans out. But Ron, where do you stand on the Hackershack?
I don't have an issue with it. You know,
really,
as a player, I don't, man. As a player, you know, as a professional player,
hitting
the gym,
work
on your craft.
Mm.
You are a professional. That's how I look at it. It's a part of the game. It's a strategy, you know, that has been adapted by some coaches. You know, obviously not everyone does it. But, you know, it's in the game. You're trying to win. You know, step up to the line. You knock the free throws down. They stop doing it. To me, I don't have an issue with it at all. I mean, you know, obviously I do really think because of the attention that, you know, that, you know, I mean, to me, the announcers, people that, you know, call the game, they bring so much attention to something that the NBA will, you know, they'll really address it. And you have a lot of these young owners, you know, that want to change things. Anyway, I think they will do something, unfortunately. I don't know what they will do. Kind of like I said, I don't know what you could do to change it.
I'll tell you exactly what you do. You just make it the same rules it is after 2 minutes. That it's the two shots and the ball. Nobody would ever do it again.
Yeah.
If it's two shots, if you foul away from the ball, and when you say it out loud, that doesn't sound unreasonable. You foul away from the ball, it's two shots and the ball. Then you foul the person with the ball. You know what I'm saying? So to your point, Phil, about, well, what do you do when you're trying to stop the clock? Just foul the person that has the ball. You don't have to foul the guy that's not on the ball. That's
right, yeah, you always with the ball, yeah.
Yeah, so. And that's my only thing with it. To me, that isn't part of basketball, hitting a guy that's not even in the play. That's not part of the game. Now, if you're trying to make a play on the ball and you inadvertently foul somebody, okay, fine, call the foul. And you're right. And then that guy, go to the line and knock your shots down. But the guy that's just out on the wing waiting for a pass or whatever, and you foul him, yeah, it should be two shots in the ball. And that goes away instantly.
Such a wrong point. I mean, with it being the reason they do this, how bad of a free throw shooter do you have to be for them to use this strategy? I mean, and that's the whole point. They're not doing this to guys that are shooting 60%, 70%. I mean, they're doing it to the guys that are like 41%. And to me, that's the root problem. So that's why I don't have a problem with it. It's just about strategy. And anything, if you can find a weakness on that team, you capitalize on it. If you know you have that weakness, you go to the gym and you work on it and you fix it. Because, I mean, everybody should be able to make, you know, 60% of their free throw. I mean, it's not that tough. I mean, you got Steph Curry shooting 92%. I don't think it's a stretch to say someone else could shoot 60, you know, shoot 51%. But to me, you should be able to make more than half for as easy of a shot that it is. So that's why I don't have a problem with it. It's just strategy. We like that about sport, you know, finding weaknesses and being able to capitalize on it and not bailing these guys out.
Yeah, but if I look at it, if I put that in the context of a different sport, that's like saying, all right, if you want to kick a field goal within 30 yards, your field goal kicker can't do it. The quarterback has to do it. I mean, that's not what you have on the floor. You know, Dwight Howard, DeAndre Jordan, you don't have them on your team because they can sink 9 out of 10 free throws. You got them because they're high.
But that's what's different about football. I mean, football, it is very specialized. Every position is specialized. Basketball is not. Basketball, you have to play both sides of the field. You don't have the running back playing safety in the NFL. That's because they're specialized. So, you know, that argument, that doesn't even hold water. That's completely apples and cantaloupes. I mean, that's apples and star fruit. I mean, that's just way off base because it is that specialized. Basketball is different. That's what I like about it. You have to be able to play many different positions. You have to be able to have many different skill sets. You know, you mentioned about the goon. You don't like goons in basketball. Well, that would be a specialized position. You just go in there and hurt the other player. But, you know, basketball, you're supposed to be able to play defense, you know, shoot the basketball, do all these different things, pass, dribble. You can't just go out there and do one thing and expect, okay, you know, I'm a pitcher in the American League, and I don't have to go to bat. You know, no, that's not what this is. You may have to shoot a free throw if you play in the NBA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and
I don't think you'll ever get rid of it because as long as the person has the ball, you can still foul them.
Right.
So you would still be able to use that as a strategy once they get the ball. So Dwight Howard, he still demands the ball quite a bit.
Exactly.
So you just foul him when he gets it. You know, DeAndre Jordan might not touch it as much. A team could kind of keep it out of his hands. But, you know, you could still have that strategy and say, hey, once he gets the ball, let's foul. So it will never totally go away in that regard.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I'm at, too, is that, you know, yeah, that it's, yeah, you don't have to foul the guy off the ball. That's my point. You know, if you want to do that, if you want to put him on the line, fine, then put him on the line every time he touches the ball. But let's not put him on the line just because he was jogging up the court and your dude ran over and grabbed him. To me, it's just silly to me. And not to mention it's hard to watch because it just, I mean, I get it. The purpose is to disrupt the flow of the game. But from the fan perspective, it's next to impossible to watch and enjoy that. But let's look at that series a little bit closer. It looks like it's tied up 2 games apiece. I see they go back to L.A. Who's gonna get this game five victory? Who's gonna be the first to 3 wins? And you know the statistics on it. In a tied up series, the first team to 3, I want to say, I think it's the better part of 70 something percent winning percentage. The team that gets to 3 wins first. So who do you got here tonight? You going Clippers or you going with the Spurs?
Well, you know, we'll let Ron finish his drive-through order over there. That's what it sounded like he was doing. But I think that the Clippers are going to win Game 5. And I thought that the Spurs missed a big opportunity by dropping that last game. But of course, it's going to be tough to beat the Clippers 3 games straight. But you stole one at home from the Clippers. Then they won huge in Game 3. But the Clippers bounced back and won that Game 4, but I felt like if the Spurs had won that game over, a series would have been done. But I think the Clippers bounce back once again and get Game 5, and I think they'll end up closing it out in, you know, 6 or 7 games.
What you think, Ron?
Man, I'm kind of following along those lines. Man, I really think, you know, San Antonio will pick up the win tonight. If they pick up this win, they will win the series. Obviously, if they lose tonight, I think it'll go Game 7. They'll probably lose the series. But I just thought that the Clippers played great in Game 4. You know, obviously they got some contributions, you know, some great contributions off the bench with Austin Rivers. And I just don't know if you can have that many guys play that well at the same time again. You know, that's always the tough thing about basketball.
Right.
You know, it's possible. But, you know, that Clippers team, like that, I just don't know if it'll happen again. I think Pop will make some adjustments, you know, so I think they'll be really ready tonight.
You know, you bring up Austin Rivers, and I almost owe Austin and Doc Rivers an apology because when I heard that the Clippers picked up Austin Rivers, I thought, really? I mean, I felt like it wasn't a basketball decision. I felt like it wasn't a decision made in the best interest of the team. I felt like it was nepotism in its finest that, you know, he wanted to throw his son a bone. And, you know, I'd never seen anything from Austin Rivers to make me say, oh, this is this guy's going to have a great NBA career. He's going to be one, you know. I just never looked at him in that fashion. And quite honestly, up until game four, he lived up to that expectation, you know, that he was really just taking up a roster spot. And I actually lost just a little bit of respect for Doc Rivers and his coaching ability, you know, putting himself in that situation, bringing his son on the team. But man, he stepped up in game four and showed that it wasn't a, you know, it wasn't some type of sympathy play that Doc made the call to bring him, that made the trade with Boston to bring him to L.A., that he is a contributor. And you said it right. I mean, they gave him, you know, Chris Paul, team captain, gave him the game ball, and rightfully so. He was, now granted, they got big contributions from Blake Griffin and Chris Paul. Let's not look past that. But in a lot of ways, you definitely can say that Austin Rivers' play in the second half definitely fueled the team and definitely was enough to put them over the top. And I, for one, never saw it. If you would have asked me at the start of game four, who has to step up and have a big game in order for the Clippers to win, Austin Rivers would have never came out of my mouth.
I don't think anyone would have said that.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Yeah, you're right. Because I would probably say the person, and if I'm not mistaken, I don't think he's had a big game yet. And you know, now I'm thinking about it, that could be tonight. You never know. It's Jamal Crawford.
I've actually been concerned about Jamal Crawford because I don't know. And maybe we need to go and do some research and figure out what the curse of the Sixth Man of the Year award. Because it seems like you win the Sixth Man of the Year award and you fall apart. Let's start with Lamar Odom. Lamar Odom with the Lakers was Sixth Man of the Year, and well, we all know what happened to him. Then you had the Jet in Dallas. Shoot, he ended up getting traded and was in Boston. Then you had Jamal Crawford. Well, hold on, let me go back. Then you had J.R. Smith. Shoot, he won Sixth Man of the Year and completely fell apart the next year. And now we're seeing the same thing out of Jamal Crawford. They need to stop handing out this award because it is the death of a bench, a role player's career. You get the Sixth Man of the Year award, man, and you just go to pieces.
But this is getting out of hand out there in Houston right now, Terrence.
Yeah, I think you can go ahead and just go ahead and chalk this one up. Houston will be moving on. Dallas is gone, and it looks like it's unfortunate because it looks like Dallas did everything they were supposed to do in terms of roster moves, but their window is closed. They, you know, you can no longer, after this season, I don't think you can no longer look at that Dallas as being an elite West Conference team. And I think you have to say, and I think after this year, I'm a bold statement, hang on to your seats, but I think we'll be saying the exact same thing about the Oklahoma City Thunder. I don't think we will be able to consider Oklahoma City an elite team in the West because with Scott Brooks gone, I think Scott Brooks is the first domino to that team being broken up and dismantled. I've said all along, and Phil, you can vouch on this, I've said all along, Westbrook, Durant cannot coexist on the same team. They will have to break this team up. And with Scott Brooks gone, I think that's the first piece of the puzzle to see that happen. I could be wrong, but that's how I see it.
You know, Terrence, many times you are wrong, but you're probably right in this rare instance here. But, I don't think that Westbrook and Durant are going to be able to coexist. I think Durant is the one that's going to be able to hold on, and he'll be the one that remains in Oklahoma City. But, I mean, there's no telling. It could be that situation where both of those guys leave. Mm. You know, where Westbrook, you know, has a situation where he thinks he could go be a nice fit, and then Durant just wants out of town. You know, I think he had made some disparaging comments about the media there, you know, so he may be fed up. So they may lose both. I mean, that whole team may get blown up from, you know, the coaching staff on down to the roster. So, yeah, we could debate that, or, you know, we could say, you know, who's going to coach the team next year. So, I mean, I don't know who that's going to be. Maybe somebody can shed some light on who they think is going to replace Coach Brooks next year.
Ron, who do you see as being the best fit of the available coaches out there? Who's the best fit to take over the helm in OKC?
I mean, man, that's a tough call. Let's name some names who are available.
There's only been a couple of names that I've even heard nationally. You know, they're talking Billy Donovan out of Florida. Kevin Ollie is a sexy pick, except Kevin Ollie has been very emphatic about he's not leaving Connecticut. Then, of course, you can bring Mark Jackson out of the booth, which I would love to see.
Yeah, you know, I'm just not a fan of bringing, you know, a college coach in thinking that's going to be the guy who's going to take you to the next level.
Right.
You know, when you had a Brooks there, you know, a veteran coach with veteran players, you know, did a great job, you know, despite, you know, what, you know, the injuries and everything they had to battle through. And you let him go, and you think you're going to bring in a rookie coach that's going to do better? I just don't see that. You know, maybe a Mark Jackson. If out of the three, I could see that. But it'll be interesting to see which way they go. You know, I think I'm kind of like you. I don't think this was a good move. You know, I hear a lot of people talk about, well, you know, this was a move to try to keep Durant in Oklahoma. I'm thinking this is a move this will be the move that makes him leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, this will be the move to keep him. You know, especially if you bring in a rookie coach.
Yeah,
I don't think that's going to be something he would fare well with.
Yeah, I was always pretty critical of Scott Brooks because I felt like he took him as far as he could take him. I felt like when it got to the playoffs, he got outclassed by the likes of the Phil Jacksons and the Greg Popovich. And that's not really a slight against him. Most coaches would get outcoached by Pop and Phil Jackson if that's what you had to deal with in the postseason every year. So I was always been very critical of him, saying that he just didn't have it to be able to outcoach the teams and the coaches that he was going to find himself going up against. But I agree with you. Removing him, you should have did it before now, because they essentially all grew up together. Durant, Westbrook, Scott Brooks, they essentially all grew up together. Now, they're veterans, Westbrook and Durant. You bring a young coach in, and now they're veterans. Look, it's hard to get Westbrook to do what you want anyway. Do you think somebody green can come in and tell this dude to stop jacking up shots? Not happening. So I agree with you there. A college coach doesn't stand a chance getting Westbrook to, you know, to get him in line to run whatever offense he wants to run. I see that as being a tough fight. Now, the reason that Kevin Ollie's name gets thrown in, to your point about this was a move to keep him there, if you think back, Ron, Kevin Ollie was still with the Supersonics when Durant came in the league. In fact, Kevin Ollie was kind of, and this is from Durant's words, Kevin Ollie kind of served as a mentor to him when he first came in. So Durant has a lot of love, admiration, and respect for Kevin Ollie. However, although you can't trust college coaches, I actually believe him when he says he has no interest in going to the NBA and that he's going to stay at Connecticut, that he's going to honor his obligation there. I actually believe him when he says it.
Yeah, I believe it too.
So, yeah, so I don't
believe a word of it.
oh, Phil, I'll never believe it.
No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know Kevin Ollie good enough, but that's what I like to hear people say. Like, you know, we've seen all these coaches, Nick Saban, and I mean, all these guys, Urban Meyer, when they say, oh, I'm staying put. I mean, I'll be here for the rest of my career. You know, and then the next day they announce they're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen it all. You know, used to, I would believe it. But and I wouldn't blame the guy. I mean, if you're, I think his salary, I just looked it up, Kevin Ollie, you know, $1.03 million.
Right.
He's making, you know, $1 million a year. Go to the NBA and they'll pay you $3, $4, you know, $5 million, whatever it may be. That'd be very hard to turn down, especially if it's with a player that you already have a relationship with, and, you know, you want to further your career. So now, I wouldn't blame him, but, you know, that'd be hard to turn down. So he may have just been speaking what he felt like he should say, but, man, that's a tough opportunity to say no thanks to.
Well, and the thing is, he made those statements before the job was available, you know. This was before there was even an opening when he made those statements, you know, and he may be biting his tongue right now saying, man, I wish I hadn't said that. And, I mean, because if you really look at it on paper, it's almost a Steve Kerr kind of move. I mean, you may not have any interest in going to the NBA, but who could turn down, A, the money, and, B, the opportunity to coach Durant and Westbrook in their prime? I mean, that's, you know, that would be tough to walk away from, you know, if you had any type of aspirations of seeing what you could do at the next level. Now, I think the difference is for Ollie is that I don't think he's been in the college game long enough, although he does have a championship already. I don't think he's been in the college game long enough to feel like, you know, he wants to test himself at the next level. You know, if you told me he'd been there for 6-7 years, made it to a couple of Final Fours and a championship, yeah, go to the pros. What else you got to prove? You know, but he's only been in Connecticut, what, 2 years, 3 years tops?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this was...
Yeah, that's his alma mater, too. So that's, you know, if it wasn't his alma mater, I think he'd be gone.
Yeah, see, that's the other half.
Yeah, he may already have his dream job. You know, that's right. Yeah.
Exactly. And you know what? And everybody doesn't want to coach pro ball. You know? Everybody doesn't want to do it. You know, they've got to make a move and do something. And I guess only time will tell. But in terms of making a move, there'll be a lot of moves made Thursday night at this draft. Real quick, guys, because we're getting on the tail end of the show. Real quick, you tell me, who is the number one overall pick come Thursday night? Is it Jameis? Is it Mariota? Phil, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a little bit anticlimactic. I think it will be Winston. That may not be the pick that I would make, but with that being his home state of Florida, you know, at least where he played football, I think he's from Alabama.
Right.
But, you know, being, you know, playing in Tallahassee now, I think that's going to be a fit that they're comfortable with. They're looking for a quarterback. So I think it's Jameis Winston.
What do you think there, Ron?
I mean, yeah, I think it'll be the same thing. I mean, I think, you know, they're looking for, you know, they need somebody who's, you know, pro-ready right now. And, mm-hmm. I mean, Rob reports, you know, that's what everybody's saying. He's ready right now with Mariota. They're saying, you know, it might be still a few years before he is, you know. So I think it'll be Winston.
Yeah, and I said all along I thought Winston was the better quarterback, and it does seem like a no-brainer for Tampa to make that call. But there's a lot of people out there talking about that there's some back office movement, some trades going on that might change all of this, and it may not be as wide open as clear-cut as we think. And there's still that outside shot that the Eagles are still trying to make a move to. Now they can't get to number one. I don't think they can do that. But they may be making some moves to try to make something happen. and we'll see. But I think we're all in agreement there. I think that's the first time that we all agreed on the exact same thing there. So that's a good job there. We all agreed. But yeah, I see it being Jameis Winston. But let's see if we agree on what goes down on Saturday night. Now that's the draft on Thursday. Saturday night is the fight of the century. Now, you've got Mayweather going up against Pacquiao, fight that's been in the making for over 5 years. Doesn't seem like it's going to be a knockout. It's going to be a decision, okay? But who do you see coming out ahead on this one, Ron? This time I'll start with you.
Watching Mayweather, I mean, you know, his defensive skills is unlike anything I've ever seen. Honestly, I hope Pacquiao wins. I just don't know if he's able to. Especially if it's not a knockout. You know, I think if it comes down to a decision, you know, it goes the distance. I think it'll be Mayweather to win.
Okay. What about you, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, my answer, you know, maybe we all three agree on this too. My answer is going to kind of mirror what Ron said. And everyone that I've talked to, everyone that I hear on sports talk and all that, says pretty much the same thing that I believe. They think Mayweather is going to win, but they're hoping that Pacquiao does. I don't know how anyone could root for Mayweather. I mean, he just doesn't seem like a very good guy. I don't know how you could ever root for someone like that, but everyone seems to be pulling for Pacquiao. 5 years ago, I would have, you know, swore that Pacquiao would have won that fight, but just like it's been well documented, Mayweather likes to catch fighters that he fights, you know, once they're past their prime, once they get a little bit older, and then he takes the fight. So once you saw Pacquiao get knocked out and see that he's slowing down a little bit, I think that's when he finally came, you know, with some terms that they could agree on to make the fight happen. So, I mean, I don't think Pacquiao will be completely ineffective. I mean, I think it'll be a decent fight, but I just think, you know, Mayweather is one of those Bernard Hopkins type guys. You know, he doesn't slow down. He doesn't age. He's, you know, the same fighter today that he was, you know, 15 years ago. So I think he will be able to come out with a win. And it could be a knockout. I mean, he is, you know, a great, great talent. But I'll be pulling for Pacquiao. But I just don't think Pacquiao has the reflexes and the quickness anymore that he had 5 years ago. So I think he loses.
I am so shocked and disappointed to hear both of y'all say that y'all are rooting for Pacquiao. That's just shocking to me. Yeah.
Well, we're good guys, man.
Oh, whatever. Yeah, Mayweather's going to win the fight, and I actually want him to win the fight. I want him to retire undefeated. And I want him to push all this noise up that I've been listening to for 5 years. You know, there were a couple of fights there that I actually went against Mayweather. I didn't think he would. I thought Ricky Hatton had the punching power that could catch him. And, of course, he put Ricky Hatton to sleep. But, of course, so did Pacquiao. And I thought that Vargas was as big as he was. I thought he wouldn't be able to handle Vargas, but he put Vargas to sleep too. So I gave up on betting against Mayweather after those two fights back to back. But speaking of going to sleep, everybody knows it. If you watch the fight game at all, you go to sleep once, oh, it's so easy for you to go to sleep again. And Pacquiao went to sleep, y'all. Y'all remember all those internet memes that were going around with Pacquiao taking a nap in the ring after his fight with was it Madonna? I can't remember. Can't remember exactly who it was, but what I do know is he clearly went to sleep. I mean, we know what happened to Roy Jones Jr. Roy Jones Jr. was the baddest man on the planet. He messed around and went to sleep and couldn't stop going to sleep in the ring. I think his next 4 or 5 fights he was knocked out cold. So I can easily see Pacquiao going out the exact same way. But I'm shocked at the hate that y'all are throwing on Mayweather. I mean,
How can you lie to somebody you can like Mayweather? I mean, they did an interview with Stephen A. Smith.
Uh-huh.
You know, he went to prison, I think it was for beating his girlfriend or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And Stephen A. Smith was asking about that, what he learned from it. And, you know, I just can't stand someone. First, I mean, he's just not a good person. But then when you do something bad and you can't hold up to it, you know, he kept saying, you know, if Mayweather would have stopped the woman, like they say, where's the video? I mean, that's what he says all the time. I don't know if you've seen the interview with Rachel Nichols, where she just hammered him. I mean, just completely, you know, just didn't take it easy on him like, you know, most reporters would.
Right.
But that's the only thing he can say is they don't have the video of it. I mean, it just doesn't even make any sense, but he's just one of those cats that, you know, you make mistakes, and you don't own up to it, and it's everyone else's fault. You know, you blame, hey, you know, it's the people that you hang out with, man, you know, they get into something, and they gonna pull you down with them. You know, I mean, so he's blaming everything else bad in his life, going to prison, on other people instead of saying, hey, what I did was wrong. You know, I want to learn from it. I want to get better, but he doesn't. I mean, and he's never had a role model. I mean, you look at his family. I mean, they're scum too, so
whoa.
I just don't know how anyone
can.
I mean, but they are. I mean, but you know they are. I mean, and that's not bad to say. I mean, all the things that they've been involved with, I mean, I just don't know how anyone could root for Mayweather. I don't know. I mean, I'm just one of those guys. I go for the good guys. Now, good guys rarely win out, but I just don't know how anyone could root for a person like Mayweather.
See, and this is the age-old argument that we find ourselves, that we get into all the time. Phil, I'm able to separate the person from the persona. And you sometimes, I think, you get caught up in the persona, and it prevents you from separating that from the man. Listen, just like with Tiger Woods, just like with Michael Vick, or any of these cats, I don't care about all that extra nonsense. It doesn't affect me one way and or another. If you want to have two pit bulls and let them fight for money, I don't care. But if you can throw a touchdown, a 70-yard touchdown bomb, come on, let's get with it. Dude, if you got a girl in every city on tour, I don't care. But on Sunday afternoon, if you can chip in from 15 feet away, hey, my man. And in cases of Floyd Mayweather, if you want to get on TV and talk about you got this car and that car and all this and rub it in the faces of middle America who ain't got crap and a pot to piss in, but you want to talk about you spent $1.3 million on this car and $3 million, I don't care. But in the ring, if you undefeated and you're the baddest man on the planet pound for pound, that's what I pay to see. I don't pay to see that other stuff. And it doesn't matter to me. So, yeah, I don't have a problem rooting for him. Good guy, bad guy, doesn't matter. That's not the person I'm rooting for. I'm rooting for the boxer.
Do you like Riley Cooper or the Eagles? You root for him every Sunday? No, because it is different. Now, it may be a cultural thing where, and I see a lot of people that root for certain individuals just because of a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
But persona and character, I think that's what you're missing out. That is not, nobody has ever gone to jail for their persona. He went to jail because of his character. So see, I don't separate those two. I don't root for Riley Cooper saying, oh, he's good, you know. I know he used a little language that, you know, that he shouldn't have, but hey, I ain't worried about that. He can catch passes. No, that affected my judgment of him because I liked him before that. And once you made those statements, you know, I try to separate myself from that type of character. So, you know, now if you want to say, hey, I'm all about Riley Cooper, I don't care what he says, I don't care what he does, if he can catch a pass, then I'm all about it. That's one thing, but I don't think you agree with that sentiment. It's the same way. I just can't get on board with somebody like Mayweather. I'm not worried about, you know, him placing those bets in the cars, because it may be cute now, but, you know, in 15 years, he'll be broke, he'll be another MC Hammer, and then it's not funny. He'll be on 30 for 30, broke too, and he'll be crying about, you know, I didn't have this, and he'll be blaming it on everyone except for himself. And, but it's not even that, it's not that persona, it's his character. If you beat a woman and you don't take any ownership of that, and you blame everyone else around you. I just can't get on board with that, and I can't support you if that's the way you are. And I wouldn't watch the fight. My dad is paying for the fight and watching it in my house. Told you, I got the new TV.
Uh-oh.
That's the only reason I'm watching. I was going to boycott it because the fight should have taken place 5 years ago, but it didn't. And so I said, man, you know, if they didn't want to fight, I'm not going to support it. But I couldn't turn my pops down, you know, so I had to let my pops come over and watch the fight. So, you know, we are going to do that, but there is no way in the world that I'm going to be rooting for Mayweather. Can't do it, man. Just cannot do it.
Ron, you, before we sign off, you want some of this? Because, like I said, I'm through with this dude.
I don't know. Hey, I don't know if I want it or not. I don't know. You know, I don't know if I have a dislike for him. I just want to see him lose. You know, I don't think he's the best. I mean, he's a great fighter. I mean, you know, I'm just, you know, old school, and I like to see guys. You know, I'm a fan of guys that go out and fight. You know, he's a great defensive player. I mean, defensive boxer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but to me, you know, when I hear people talk, that doesn't make him the best because he hasn't lost. You know, to me, Ali was still the greatest, and he lost plenty of fights. But he didn't back down to nobody. He fought everybody once, twice, three times. He fought the best. And losing doesn't, you know, mean you're not good, you know, and he didn't hold no punch. You know, he fought.
Right.
You know, sometimes I just think Mayweather fights. I just think he's, you know, it's just all about, okay, I'm out, I'm gonna get more points and I'm gonna just win the fight.
Right.
You know what I mean? I wanna see the fight.
Right on.
Yeah, it's to Ron's point. I mean, I think Mayweather hangs his hat as undefeated, and, you know, talking about Ali wanted to fight the best person at that time, and I think Mayweather is so worried about that zero after the number of wins that he has that he's never really taken these big fights when, you know, the other guys were in their prime. You know, he avoids them until, you know, 5 years later, a little bit older, and then he catches them. And to Ron's point, you know, his style of fight, he doesn't, you know, go after and, you know, stand there toe to toe, you know, let's film, you know, kind of, and again, that's strategy, but I don't think it would have affected his legacy. I think he still would have went down. Let's say he would have fought these guys in the prime, you know, lost the first fight, mm-hmm. came back in the rematch, won the second one, and then they do the third fight, tiebreaker, he wins that. I think that would have made him look better in his legacy, just like Ali did. You know, Ali would fight, you know, get beat, win the rematch, and then win that third fight, too. And I think that did more to propel his legacy than if he just would have been undefeated. So I'm with Ron. I mean, I just like guys like Pacquiao that go out, they throw the punch, they don't just sit back, you know, try to pick their shots. They're brawlers, and they
go to sleep.
Fighters, and I like to see it.
Yeah.
Well, they do. That's what I'm saying. I mean, later in his career, that's what every fighter does. I mean, except for guys like Bernard Hopkins and, I mean, Mayweather, there's a few guys that can go beyond that, you know, 35, 36 years of age. But, yeah, but that's one thing, just like Ron said, they take chances. They go out, they may get caught. You know,
right.
Ali's been knocked out. That's fine. But they go out and take their chances, and they fight fearless. And I like that. But, again, it's just, I just never really liked guys that go to prison and I don't know, there's just something about that. I go for the good guys.
Well, let me just go ahead and shut both y'all down before I sign off here. You know, you talk about Ali being the greatest of all time, and of course he is. But you know what? Ali had a persona, too, that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. He was braggadocious. He talked about how pretty he was, so forth and so on, at a time where that was not the popular thing to do in an interview on camera. And he turned a lot of people off. The same way that Floyd Mayweather turns a lot of people off, based on the things that he says. And of course, you know, Ali had the whole turning Muslim and the draft dodger thing, and where, you know, again, where a lot of people lost respect for him because they saw him as a draft dodger, or you know, he was joining the Nation of Islam. So you have that whole thing too. So there's a lot of similarities there that you might not want to care to realize. There were a lot alike more so than they are different. And then you talk about the dodging the fighters and being defensive and not swinging punches. Well, like you said, I mean, that's the sport. You know, we just had this whole conversation about Hack-A-Shaq. And both of y'all said, well, that's the game allows it. That's part of the game. Well, guess what? Being a defensive fighter is part of the game. So, booyah, shut both y'all down. Anyway, it's been a great show, folks. If you like what you heard, if you like the way I just shut these two gentlemen down, then you want to hear it again, play it back over and over on repeat. Check us out on iTunes. Check out the podcast, this one and all others. And you can check us out same time again next week. Be sure to check out the show page as well at POShowRadio.com. And, hey, follow us on Twitter at POShowRadio. It has been my pleasure to bring you another fine episode of the PO Show with Big T, Cool Hand Phil, and our special guest, Basketball Hall of Famer Ron Rutland Jr. We'll be back to do this thing again for you next week. Good luck, Mayweather, Saturday night. You don't need it, boy. Go ahead and knock them fools out. We are out of here. Good night.